Welcome to Conversations Live. For more than a decade, we've brought you the best in books, entertainment, celebrity interviews, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us first. Here's your host, Cyrus Webb.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. But for a radio audience here in Mississippi, WYAD 94.1 FM and WYADonline.com are glad that you all could be with us. Also, as tuning in to our online affiliates around the world, we appreciate you all being with us as well. We're excited to welcome John W. Farrell to our program today. He's celebrating his new book, The Clock and the Camshaft and Other Medieval Inventions We Still Can't Live Without. This book is so fascinating to me because it really does make us look at the things that we use and the things that we've heard about but may not know the history of. We'll talk to John not only about what led him to writing this book, but also what these discoveries he hopes does for all of you as well. If you guys are not connected with John, we'll let you know where to find him too. John, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
The pleasure is definitely on mine. I read this book for one thing because I love history, John, so I was excited about being able to see, of course, the history of the things that you mentioned, but also I think, you know, the practicality that we still find available for us today in 2022. What was that like for you to be able to take a look at these things and also how they still impact our lives?
It was really fascinating because I don't consider myself a very technical person, you know, unless it's my kids asking me to set up like AV stuff to watch movies. My first book was about the Catholic priest who came up with the first version of the Big Bang Theory in the 1930s. And I've always was interested in the history of science, but at a level of kind of like ideas. And, you know, we tend to think of history always in terms of, you know, the great inventors or the great, you know, scientists. So whenever, you know, you're taught about the scientific revolution, you know, we hear about Copernicus, we hear about Galileo and Newton and so forth and so on. But then as I would research that, I realized that, you know, they all relied upon inventions that came quite a few centuries before them, without which they wouldn't have been able to kind of make those scientific breakthroughs. And that just made me appreciate all the work and the kind of ambition and technical achievement of human beings whose names we'll never know. We're so kind of used to like attaching a name to an invention, whether it's Thomas Edison or Alexander Graham Bell. And the scientific revolution, likewise, was really, you know, it was kind of built on the substrate of technical invention during the Middle Ages, when people were really, you know, basically working hard to make their lives better, easier. And this, of course, is exactly contrary to the kind of stereotype, you know, in culture and in literature and movies of what the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, you know, were supposed to be like.
Yeah. And John, I have to say, to add to what you just said for our audience, and I think this is one of the things, too, that makes this book fascinating, is that these things did not happen overnight. I think in the world that we live in today where we're expecting things to just happen, you know, because of the, you know, we're now used to that microwave society, that these things went through an evolution, like the clock that you talk about in the book. This was something that it did evolve. What was that like for you to see, how this really was, in many ways, a practice in patience when it came to these inventions and the way that they are now today?
Oh, yeah, exactly. The clock, for example, was basically you'd have to say it was like teamwork between blacksmiths and millwrights. And they probably did it at the instigation of a bishop who wanted to automate the ringing of bells, because in those days in the monasteries and the churches, people had to get up at midnight to say prayers, and they'd go back to sleep, and they'd get up at dawn and say prayers. And you had this whole kind of religious schedule that needed to be met. And it was pretty tiresome to have to rely on water clocks or calibrated candles, which would blow out, you know, during the night, you know, very kind of, and required constant kind of high maintenance attention. So you're presented with a problem, and the bishop probably asked these guys, like, look, can we come up with a way to make this more reliable and, you know, less kind of high maintenance? And the breakthrough there, I think, was that they were already used to, after centuries of kind of perfecting water power and even wind power, to grind grain, to full cloth, to drive their forge bellows for, you know, making iron and steel, for cutting wood, all these things. And they would basically just look at those tools they already had and say, what if we recombine these in a way to come up with a new solution. And that's what the mechanical clock was. It was basically put together with stuff they already knew how to use in other purposes, and then they just applied it ingeniously to this idea of how could we use gravity to power a mechanical clock that would last for 12 hours or more. I don't know about you, but I grew up, my parents had an old grandfather clock in our front hall, and I used to love every 2 or 3 days going down when I saw the weights hit the floor, like, okay, someone's got to open the door and, you know, pull them back up so the thing could run another 3 or 4 days. And, of course, as a kid, you don't realize this thing was invented, you know, hundreds of years before. But, you know, there I am in, like, the 1970s still using a clock like that. And, you know, people still
yeah.
have them, you know, mostly for kind of, you know, show-and-tell kind of thing. But the mechanism, once it was created, it just took off all across Europe. I mean, it really did change society in the sense that before the mechanical clock, you know, time was looked at in terms of duration of processes that people did every day, like, you know, how long is it going to take us to plow this field? How long is it going to take this, you know, for us to do this process of, like, a religious liturgy or whatever? But time was very kind of subjective in that sense. Once you had the clock in place, you could actually, you know, break things down to hours and minutes. And then within about a century, like France, for example, the king said, I want to institutionalize one time zone, you know, across the whole country. We're all going to have, you know, we're all going to know exactly what time it is. Not as exact as we do now with our iPhones and our satellites and so forth, but that
right.
created a huge change, not just in the way they did commerce, but the way they lived their lives. And it also became a kind of a like a competition, you know, like a status symbol, like, well, our church in our town has a bigger clock than yours. And so to this day, you know, when you get on a plane and fly across the country, the first thing you see when you look down at towns is, you know, church steeples, and they all have clocks in them. And that goes back to the Middle Ages. But it also it kind of set the stage for the scientific revolution, because even though they invented this ingenious device without the aid of any mathematics or principles of dynamics, as you and I would come to understand them or dread them, depending on how you liked your classes in high school, you now had time quantified in such a way that a Copernicus or a Galileo could start saying, well, you know, how many, you know, how can we break distance and force and speed down into ways that we can manipulate with mathematics? And then all of a sudden, you know, something like the scientific revolution was almost inevitable after that happened. But it wouldn't have had we not had the mechanics in place for quantifying time. And that was done by, again, everyday people who worked with their hands and used their ingenuity.
And I think, too, you know, we're willing to try. I think, again, that there are so many small undertones in this book, John, for me, because I think, unfortunately, we don't see a lot of people that have the imagination that it took to create things like the clock today. And it's funny in some ways because of how fast and the world is moving and how much technology has advanced. What was that like for you to kind of look backwards and to think about what people were willing to do, what they were willing to try, even if they didn't get it right the first time?
I think it's really amazing. For example, in the clock, I can just imagine, like, you know, these guys sitting around a fire having a beer saying, okay, this didn't work. What do we try tomorrow? And just talking about it and just coming back at it every day. But I think, again, you just had people who, especially after the disaster of the fall of the Roman Empire, it really wasn't the Dark Ages in the sense of, you know, just people living in ignorance. Of course, they were living in ignorance compared to what we think of as knowledge. But what they were doing was, like, well, picking up the pieces left over from the fall of the empire. And that included a lot of inventions that were already there, you know, like horizontal mills and vertical mills and plows, but they took them and then improved them because they thought, well, our circumstances are different. You know, one example, of course, is the very simple kind of scratch plow that people in the Middle East and the Mediterranean got by completely fine with for centuries because the soil was light in that climate. Once you moved into, you know, Europe, northern Europe, where the soil was really heavy, it's like this just wasn't going to work. And so they basically came up with, you know, the heavy plow, which was like, you know, the shear, the coulter, the moldboard, and let's get some, you know, really strong oxen to plow. And they were able to expand their output much more dramatically. So that's like a little thing. And then it's like, well, we could use horses too if we came up with a better way to harness the horse without choking it to death. So again, the things that we grew up watching on Westerns, breast harnesses, those were invented in the Middle Ages, like the early Middle Ages, when they needed to come up with a way to utilize a horse without killing it. All those kind of like – those are kind of like the baby steps at the beginning. But then once they became acquainted with milling technology and realized they could do more than just, well, okay, we can grind grain, but if we add a shaft with cams, we can actually use the mill to drive trip hammers. And trip hammers means we can pound ore, we can fold cloth, we can add a crank and start sawing wood. And believe me, one of the things that astounded me was – the level of deforestation that happened fairly rapidly in the Middle Ages when they figured out, one, how to institute kind of like controlled burning so that they could clear more fields for farming and use the ash from the fire to kind of enrich the soil. And then, of course, you know, chopping down the wood so they could build. And, you know, by 1250, which is still a century before the Black Death, which is, you know, kind of right around when, you know, historians kind of see the end of the Middle Ages as in advance of, say, like the Renaissance. But you had countries like Germany, like, hugely deforested to the point where they were starting to worry, you know, we're going to run out of stuff. And that's something that we tend to just associate with the modern era, like we're using up our fossil fuels and we're deforesting. But I think it's a mark of how successful they were even in those days that it became an issue for them too, because they were so efficient at basically, you know, mining the wood and using their resources.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, and you and I didn't discuss that before we went live here. That was one thing that struck me in Chapter 3 that carries the title of the book, The Crank, and the Camshaft. And there you talk about the deforestation taking place and accelerating there in the latter part of the Middle Ages. So I want to ask you this, John. We're going to let our audience know, of course, how they can get the book and stay connected. But was this the book that you intended to write? I'm curious, when you set out on this journey, is this, were you surprised even by what you discovered?
Yes, yeah. As I sort of alluded to with my first book, I was interested in the history of the science from kind of like, you know, the great figures, like, you know, go back and look at, you know, Copernicus and then the ideas that motivated them. And indeed, in the Middle Ages, even before Copernicus, in the universities, which, you know, were also an invention of the Middle Ages, you had some breakthroughs intellectually. The clerics and the monks and the professors kind of adopted as they kind of rediscovered Aristotle, who'd been lost after, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire. I know that's kind of a big chapter in the book, and I won't go too far off track, but I was initially interested in those things. Like, what were the ideas that preceded Newton and preceded Copernicus? And as fascinating as that is, I realized, I started to think, maybe, again, this is a function of the way we think. We tend to give ideas more power than we should. In other words, you know, yeah, ideas are great, but it's really more material things that drive people day to day that can lead to like real change. And again, the mechanical clock, I think, had, and the invention of the university, I think, those are probably more material reasons why the scientific revolution had happened inevitably, rather than just kind of all the cool ideas that, you know, one or two of these people in the Middle Ages had, and, you know, those kind of dribbled down to, you know, Copernicus and Galileo. That's kind of a fascinating kind of a mystery to follow intellectually, but I started to feel like, you know, that doesn't really grab me the way this other stuff I'm finding out is. And, like, just the whole process by which the universities came into being. You started out with, you know, the popes realizing, hey, we need to defend ourselves against the encroachments of the kings and the rulers, and we need to put all of our legal things all together, so the Bible, Roman law, and create our own system of law so that we can protect our own autonomy. And out of that, you know, came, you know, the legal basis for what became the corporations, and the universities were the first corporations. You know, we always think of corporations as just big businesses, but they were literally entities that were created in the Middle Ages to protect not just the schools, but then the craftsmen. You know, the guilds were created then for the fullers and for the tanners, and the blacksmiths were like, hey, let's get together and protect ourselves so we're not overly exploited by, you know, the powers that be. And that's a fascinating aspect of this history, too.
Yeah, it really is. And you brought up an interesting thing that is throughout the book that I was not expecting, and that was the role of the church in a lot of this as well, the role of then religion, I guess if you want to say it more broadly. Was that something that you knew going in, the role of the church when it came to a lot of these things, and astronomy when it came to these inventions?
Yes. I mean, I kind of vaguely was aware of it, but then as I read more, I realized it's – and I shouldn't have been surprised, realized, because if you go back far enough, I mean, religion and science sort of parallel each other in the sense of that they're very, you know, human activities. And I know in this country we can kind of get caught up in controversies about faith and science, which is – that's more personal. Whereas if you think of religion as a human activity, it really makes total sense that religions – had certain needs that had to be met by astronomy, because it's like, well, we need to know when to predict correctly when we should have Easter, not just next year, but for like the next 100 years. So we need good astronomy, and off they're off and running, because, well, we heard that the Arabs have much better astronomical tables than we do down in Spain. So why don't we head down there and see what we can find? And so they go down there to get the, you know, the scientific texts, and while they're there, they discover stuff they just couldn't imagine. One was all of Aristotle, who had been lost after the Roman Empire, and lots of, you know, Arabic medicine, other, you know, Plato, all sorts of other texts, and all these got translated and brought back into Europe, and that had a huge impact on the universities as well. And, of course, it caused some trouble, of course, because the bishops realized, oh, we're not sure we want to be teaching this stuff, because some of it seems to go against, you know, church traditions and doctrines, but the fact that the universities were now independent with their kind of corporate status, they could push back and say, look, don't tell us what we can't teach. And there were fights back and forth and so on, but I would argue that those were healthy fights and kind of led to all sorts of intellectual ideas that, again, bore fruit later on in the scientific revolution. But to answer your question, I think in that sense, religion and science were – they kind of grew up together. Science started out as something that – religions needed, and then it kind of, you know, took on a life of its own. But you can see that in Islam, in Christianity, and other religions. You know, well, for example, the mathematical, numerical numbers we use they're not Roman. You know, the Roman numerals were pretty bad. You really couldn't manipulate them. So we adopted the ones from India and Islam because they were more efficient. But again, those were adopted for religious reasons by the Islamic authorities as well, because they had their own particular needs for their faith.
Right, exactly. It is really a fascinating look, I think, of our connection with the past, John, but also, I think, a history that we need to know to really appreciate what we have today, because a lot of times we just take for granted the things that are here instead of thinking about how we got them. And I think a book like this definitely helps with that. Again, the book is The Clock and the Camshaft and Other Medieval Inventions We Still Can't Live Without. It is available through our friends at Amazon.com or through your favorite local bookstore. If they don't have it, I know they'd be more than happy to order it for you. And, John, what about you? How can they stay connected with you?
In addition to Amazon and the bookstores, the audiobook just came out at the end of January, so that's newly available. And I know audiobooks are – a lot of people love to listen to audiobooks. I know I do, especially in the car. I have a website where I've compiled a lot of my other freelance writing and so forth. It's basically my last name, Farrell, with media. So it's farrellmedia.com, F-A-R-R-E-L-L-M-E-D-I-A.com, and that's where I kind of put a lot of my other writings and media.
All right. Well, John, congratulations to you again. Really appreciate the time, enjoyed the conversation, and looking forward to having you back on the program again.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Well, the pleasure is definitely all mine. Appreciate that. And we thank your audience for tuning in to another great segment of Conversations Live. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying, as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live. So let's go make today amazing. Take care.